Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. April Blaski-Rychek. She is a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. And today we're going to focus on a recent paper of hers, Gendered Perspectives on Sharing the Load: Men's and Women's Attitudes Toward Family Roles and Household and Childcare Tasks. So, Dr. Blaski-Rychek, it's a pleasure to have you on the show again. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
Okay, so let's talk perhaps first a little bit about sexual division of labor. So, where does it come from exactly? Because there are different perspectives out there. There are people that have more of an evolutionary slash biological perspective, others that prefer sociocultural or socialization perspective. So where do you fall there?
Well, great question. And I think the orientation that I took in this paper was really an evolutionary perspective on sexual division of labor. And I think that, of course, your listeners and viewers are probably going to be well familiar with the logic behind my orientation of sexual division of labor being at least ultimately rooted in evolved differences between the sexes. And testing those ideas was actually the primary purpose of this research, because so much of what I read in the news about men's and women's division of primarily what they just globally refer to as housework or household labor and then childcare, they don't really get into the nitty-gritty. They just give these broad terms and then they attribute them to these sticky beliefs about gender roles. And I found it really frustrating that they never acknowledged even the possibility that men and women might actually have not only different strengths, but also different attitudes and interests in engaging in different types of household tasks and childcare tasks. In fact, I could find not a single paper. I found one paper that looked at, and this is, of course, by somebody who's well versed in evolutionary psychology. Stephen Rhodes and his son did some research on tenure track men's and women's time spent on childcare, 25 different childcare tasks, and also their enjoyment of those tasks. And they documented substantial sex differences in among these tenure track faculty, women, young mothers, young fathers, all tenure track faculty at high level institutions, sex differences in time spent on childcare, but also substantial sex differences in enjoyment of those childcare tasks. And I could find not a single paper that actually looked at men's and women's enjoyment of various household activities and tasks, and not just in the house, but actually outside of the house. And you hear people complain that, well, doing laundry and cooking and cleaning, those are day to day to day to day, right? And they build up and they aggregate in time. But on the other hand, when you look at various types of other tasks like car maintenance and yard work and shoveling, and for those of us who live in the polar Midwest where it gets to 20 below for 3 months out of the year, engaging in car maintenance really sucks. Right. And so it's actually useful to consider how do men and women actually feel about these tasks. And so I came at this entirely from an evolutionary perspective, right? That women should have evolved to enjoy childcare tasks more than men. And men and women differ in their strengths and in their personality attributes and values that may be relevant for consideration of different types of tasks, right? We know as you've had guests on your podcast talk about these differences. Women score higher than men around the world in conscientiousness, right? Attention to detail, which is certainly relevant for things like cleaning, laundry. They're more as interested in aesthetic things, novelty, shopping, right? Scheduling and maintenance is relevant for conscientiousness. So it's not even just about. It is about parental care, right? And devotion to children and that feeling of I think the the fulfillment that comes from feeling needed, right, by a young one, by an infant or a young child. But it's also those personality traits and values that are relevant for thinking about what men and women may gravitate toward. And I found it really frustrating to read so many media reports that didn't even acknowledge the possibility that differences between men and women, fundamental inherent differences in traits, values, preferences, could be underlying some of the way they spend their time. Mm-hmm. And I say this, by the way, as somebody who, I have three kids, but I also am in a partnership where my husband was a full-time stay-at-home dad for 10 years. Right. So I don't typify, right, the normal. And not to say that my experience of one offers some, you know, offers me some credibility, because it doesn't. I'm just saying that, you know, people differ in their individual experiences, and nobody was asking people about their individual preferences.
So, I mean, just to try to understand the kinds of tasks that men and women prefer, do these tasks share certain specific characteristics? Because I was thinking that if we go at it from an evolutionary perspective, then across time, and particularly if we compare, for example, traditional societies like hunter-gatherers, horticulturalists, and so on, with modern industrialized societies, the specific tasks we're talking about would be very different, but still we would still find tasks that men and women tend to prefer the most. So, I mean, are there any commonalities across those tasks? Yeah, sure.
Yeah, between modern and more traditional societies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was so focused on like what goes on in modern society, and I think that's an interesting point you raise. There are pieces that we asked about, childcare tasks that we asked about, that I think are relatively specific to more modern societies. For example, you know, scheduling play dates and arranging birthday parties. Anything involving scheduling and keeping track of a calendar, that type of stuff, both in terms of childcare and also just managing a household that way, women did enjoy that task more and preferred that they handle more of that, and men less so. But there are other things that I think are common to what you would see in more traditional societies, like nighttime care. And you know, in our study, we had two samples, right? We have emerging adults, and we asked them to consider how they foresaw. So do you want me to explain maybe like what we did in this study, and mm-hmm. then break down the tasks?
Yes,
okay.
Sure.
Okay. So there were, in our study, we had multiple facets and two samples. So one sample was emerging adult college students. And I mentioned the sample because I think this is important. These are students who, I work at a very progressive university, and these students are awash in gender egalitarian views. Mm-hmm. Now, some people could argue that, well, 4 years of college education isn't going to remove, right, 18 years of socialization, you know, in gender role, I don't know, schemas, but I would argue that it's pretty strong, the 4 years of their gender egalitarian education. But these students, we asked them to think about managing a household and give their impression of how much they foresaw enjoying or disliking these activities. So I'm going to hate it to I'm going to love it. And then we asked them to consider, and then we asked them, in the ideal household, how would you split this up? Would this primarily be the responsibility of your partner, or would this be equal, or would this be primarily the responsibility for you? And these were both on continuous rating scales. And then we asked them to do the same for childcare tasks, okay? Enjoyment and how they foresaw wanting to split that, each of those tasks with a partner, right, in an ideal state. And then we had a second sample that was a middle-aged adult sample. And these were participants, these were alumni of our university between the ages of 30 and 46, or 31 and 46 it ended up being. And the vast majority were cohabiting or married and in the throes of managing a household and raising children, right? So the typical person had two children. And we did the same thing with them, but instead of saying, you know, imagine in the future, we said, think about managing a household. How much do you dislike versus enjoy? I hate it. Do I love it? Household tasks, childcare tasks, and how would they prefer the split? And of course, the final portion of the questionnaire that I think was, I probably was most interested in perhaps, was where men and women in both of these samples would place themselves on a continuum, like in an ideal situation. Where would you be? Would you be the primary homemaker? Would it be more egalitarian? And this again was a continuous scale, so they could lean one way or the other, right? So homemaker on one end, totally egalitarian, right? Both equal roles for both of you. And then to the other end, primary breadwinner of the household. And so I intentionally offered those not as categorical options, because they never are, right? But actually on a continuum to get where people would lean. And we asked participants to tell us where they would be in a situation in a household with no constraints, and then acknowledging that, of course, there are going to be constraints, right? Not everybody has things the way they want them. What could you live with, right? What could you live with? And in both of those cases, it doesn't matter what we asked them, and it didn't matter which cohort it was, the young adults, these 20-year-olds or the 35-year-olds who were currently raising children, the sex difference was the same. They were it was a strong difference, nearly 1 point apart on that 7-point rating scale in terms of leaning toward homemaker as opposed to breadwinner in the direction you would expect. So anyway, so that's the setup of the study. right. And now I'm forgetting the specific question that I wanted to.
The question was basically about if the kinds of tasks that men and women prefer have the same kinds of characteristics, and if we could compare them to similar tasks than in more traditional society.
Yeah. Okay. So some of the childcare tasks in particular that you could compare to other societies, nighttime care, right? Being available at night, emergency care, right? When a child is sick and in need. Also just daily oversight, right? Making sure they're fed, making sure that that their diapers are changed and that they're clothed, you know, all of those things, I think are particularly relevant. And then there were also things like disciplining children, right? And that's one thing, that's an area where we did not see substantial sex differences in disciplining children. And in fact, both men and women were kind of like, ooh, I don't like that so much. As opposed to, they like a lot of, you know, both men and women like a lot of tasks, including middle-aged adults. They enjoy playing with their children. They enjoy taking them on outings. There wasn't a single childcare task that middle-aged men who were actively engaged in childcare, right, along with the women in that cohort, there wasn't a single task that middle-aged men enjoyed more than women did. There were those that they enjoyed similarly to women, right? Disciplining children, providing some cognitive support, for example, helping with homework. And that has been documented in other literature that men, that fathers are spend time helping with homework and playing with their kids. Mm-hmm. And I think those types of support are relevant in a variety of societies, no matter how modern, right? Helping with cognitive development, emotional development, play.
That's very interesting, because I mean, isn't it the case that we know that even in human societies and human families, women tend to invest much more than men in their children? I mean, so wouldn't that have any sort of influence in terms of how much time they spend in these kinds of tasks? What percentage of them fall to any of the sexes? And I mean, those kinds of questions.
Do you mean that in humans compared to other species, males invest so much more in offspring?
No. In fact, I was saying that within humans, isn't it the case that females tend to invest much more in their offspring there than males? Or is that wrong?
Yeah. No, you're totally right. And I think if anything, what we saw, well, yes, there's substantial evidence, right, that around the world, across cultures, females invest more in their offspring than males do. And we see inclinations toward investing in infants manifest in childhood, in sex differences in childhood, right? In how, you know, little girls gravitate toward infants and they gravitate toward dolls. I mean, from a very young age, right? We see these, in fact, Davis and Hines, right? Melissa Hines has a meta-analysis from 2020 showing that sex differences in toy preferences that start very early on in life have been really constant and huge, right, over the past five decades, despite, I think, massive attempts to ameliorate those sex differences. So I think that we see the roots of that, or the manifestation, right, of sex differences in parental investment still in human cultures today. And so in one sense, you could say, well, you didn't really get very big sex differences given what the logic suggests. And and one finding that I think is really interesting in our data is that the sex differences are generally smaller in our emerging adult sample, right? They were the ones who were imagining the future with a partner. You know, how would you divide, how much are you going to enjoy doing these things, or how would you like to split these things up? The sex differences were there, but they weren't as strong when they showed up as in the middle-aged adult sample. And this fits, you know, like these emerging adults they have strong gender egalitarian views. I would like to do systematic research on this, how often you have women who have a very egalitarian plan, and they really are kind of they're kind of rocked by what becoming a parent does to them. And there's some systematic research out of, say, the study of mathematically precocious youth that shows that sex differences in priorities and values and orientation toward family as opposed to career, those sex differences, even among these super highly able men and women, the sex differences get larger, right, when these men and women become parents. And so I think we saw some evidence of that in our sample, where the sex differences in enjoyment as opposed to foreseen enjoyment, and the sex difference in how you would like to split up your tasks as opposed to, in the emerging adult sample, how do you foresee wanting to divvy up these tasks, the sex differences were larger in the middle-aged adults who were currently in throes of it all. Now, some people could take a counterpoint and be like, well, that's just because they're not as, you know, this is an older generation. Well, their average age was like 35. They're not that old. They were educated and living in a very gender egalitarian society, I would argue, right? The U.S. has been highly gender egalitarian for quite a while. We could try to test these ideas against one another, but my interpretation of what's going on here is that this is a developmental effect, right? That you acknowledge that you might actually enjoy something or prefer having ownership over a task more than in your ideal young self stage of life thought you would. Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes sense. But I just wanted to ask you, isn't it still the case, unless this is wrong, of course, but isn't it still the case that particularly since the 60s, 70s, with women emancipation movements and all of that, and women's rights and so on, that across time, there's been more and more sharing of these households and childcare tasks between men and women. I mean, particularly in more in more egalitarian countries, isn't it the case that nowadays, in comparison to perhaps the 60s, the 50s, and so on, that men perform much more of these tasks than they did before, and perhaps they share more of these tasks than they did before, particularly when it comes to the household and childcare.
I think that, so in time surveys, there is evidence that men over the past several decades, at least in the US, have, and I think that this would be the same in various Western societies, men do spend more time on household and childcare tasks. Broadly speaking, again, right, these are generally broad categories that they ask people about, like, how many hours do you spend helping out at the house, you know? So they don't really divvy it up into very specific tasks. But yes, men do help more. And women do, and they also invest more time in the workplace than they used to. One interesting finding in the literature is that that hours spent on childcare and with children are higher now overall than decades ago. So working moms, for example, they work full time and they also spend a lot of time with their kids. In the 60s, more women were stay-at-home moms. That doesn't mean that they were spending every moment with their kids the way that moms may feel pressure to now. Do you see what I'm saying?
I see that. Couldn't it also be the case that perhaps since people nowadays tend to move more from, for example, people who live in rural areas tend to move to cities and so on, and then they live apart from their families, from their parents and so on, that perhaps nowadays it's harder for people to get help from, for example, to have grandmothers, grandfathers help raising their grandchildren. And so that would be one of the reasons why nowadays women also have to spend more time with childcare tasks than previously.
I think especially in you know, in more privileged areas, right? Women and men can afford to pay to have those certain services provided for them, as opposed to actually having a community of childcare providers through their family and kin. And I think, you know, people have written about this as a sad change of society, right? Especially American society. You know, Bob Putnam in Bowling Alone and Charles Murray in Coming Apart has written about these ideas. It's cool that you make that connection. I think that's a big issue. And as another topic, and I imagine there might be some literature on that, but are, you know, the degree to which mothers, when they can, when their daughters and sons have children, particularly their daughters, since we know thinking about that link of investment, are they more likely to try to move, right, to be close to those grandchildren when possible?
Yeah, because I mean, I was just thinking also, because cooperative breeding during our evolutionary history has played a big role. So, I mean, that perhaps nowadays the time men and women invest and the resources they invest in their children and so on would be perhaps significantly higher than what we see in more traditional societies, where perhaps grandparents and other members of the family and even other members of the community help raising children.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, and if you don't have community helpers or family helpers, then the cost of childcare can be quite high. I think that's a great point.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to go back to where this comes from an evolutionary perspective, I mean, what is the evolutionary rationale behind the sex differences that lead to these sexual division of labor? And what is the evolutionary rationale behind men preferring certain kinds of tasks and women others?
I think for childcare, the logic behind what's going on with childcare and household tasks might be slightly different. And especially for childcare, it also can depend upon the age of the child. But in general, I think there are a couple of really important pieces of evolutionary logic that would implicate women across cultures as more invested in child care, child oversight, making sure they're healthy, fed, all of that, especially in infancy, right? Complete and committed care of offspring. And that is, you know, one is just parental sex differences in minimum obligatory parental investment, right? So if we know that women have historically had a limited number of gametes, limited number of eggs, they face at least 9 months of investment, and they're limited by how much they can reproduce in terms of they're limited by their number of eggs and how much they can reproduce and in that time. So they're going to invest substantially in those infants that they have. And that doesn't mean that fathers won't invest, right? But there are things that are working against dads to invest as much as moms do. Dads don't face 9 months of obligatory parental investment, right? Their requirements are quite slim. They have a never-ending reproduction of sperm, you know, just a few minutes for copulation. And so this, the whole means by which reproduction is occurring for men is different. And we know that biparental care is really important for offspring. And so there are forces working toward, you know, men engaging in offspring care. But at the same time, right, when they have so much less required investment over ancestral history, men who chose to not invest in offspring or pursue additional mating opportunities would have outreproduced men who did not, right? Men who did not engage in sexual opportunities would have been outreproduced by men who did. In other words, every ounce of parenting effort is competing with mating effort, and men who did not engage in mating effort would have been outreproduced by men who did. And so another piece of that puzzle, right, is paternity certainty. Mama's baby, papa's maybe, right? As David Buss likes to say,
yeah.
Have to throw that in, right? As my graduate advisor, I always chuckled when I definitely, you know, chuckled the first time I heard that phrase, like, oh, that's so funny. And it's also very memorable.
Yeah, but I interviewed him twice this year just because of his new book. So, yeah.
Yes, it's so great. It's just an excellent book. I've read so many good books this year. And his being top on the list. So paternity uncertainty, right? You have men are less certain of their parentage over the long span of evolutionary history. Conception happened internally to the female, so males faced a risk of investing in offspring that were not their own. And you know, you have probably talked about this, but it's not like men are consciously thinking like, oh, this may not be my child, I shouldn't invest. It's more that over ancestral history, men who chose to invest in offspring, and there were times where those offspring weren't theirs, they were not only not helping themselves, they were helping some other male's genes, right, survive and presumably make it to the next generation. And so there are these evolutionary forces that are operating against that would have operated, right, to propel women toward really investing in offspring and men toward investing in offspring, right, to ensure their survival and reproductive success, but also invest in other things, right? And so, and we see that. We see the you know, in these data? Men enjoy engaging in childcare. Do they enjoy it as much as men, as women? No. And I think what's striking is that these gender differences, these sex differences manifest even in a highly egalitarian society, which suggests that those preferences, given the option to express who you are, your evolved proclivities might just shine through.
Yeah, I think that there are perhaps two points there that are very important to keep in mind whenever we talk about an evolutionary perspective, because it's very easy for certain people to feel uneasy when we say that perhaps some of these sex differences come from evolution and have a biological basis. Because I mean, first of all, as you said, it's not that men and women were doing these conscious calculations during evolution, right, that I have to behave this or that way for me to transmit my genes more efficiently to the next generation and so on. I mean, it was mostly unconscious. And also, I mean, it would be very nice and all perhaps for men to invest their resources in children that are not their own. But again, if genes predispose toward certain behaviors, I mean, if those children were from other males that perhaps were more promiscuous, those children would have been more promiscuous themselves. And so the men that would have been investing in those children, I mean, that kind of behavior would not have passed on to the next generation. And so over time, it would decrease in frequency. So.
Yeah. I think that logic of selection is so important. And I get really frustrated when people say, you know, well, men, they just need to spill their seed. And it's such a disgusting phrase, but it also doesn't clarify that nobody is, you know, as again, as David Buss would say, men are not lining up at sperm banks to donate their sperm. It's not like this conscious calculation of I got to get my genes out as far and wide as possible. But rather, right, that over the long span of evolutionary history, what facilitated gene replication were certain behaviors, whether we were consciously aware of them or not. Yeah. And I think once you become consciously aware of perhaps the ultimate rationale for why we might have the desires and preferences we do, that knowledge doesn't go away, right? So if you recognize that, you know, some people have said to me, well, like, that's so, it just takes the joy out of thinking about motherhood. If you're saying that this maternal devotion is just due to evolved mechanisms to promote, you know, gene replication. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, that doesn't mean I love my children any less. Understanding why I find it so easy to love my own children and find my neighborhood children so irritating is actually really helpful for me. You know, like, now I can try to hold this in check and monitor my behavior and try to avoid, right, the nepotistic attitudes I might have that come so naturally, right? Like, how do you work against those attitudes and feelings if you don't? I feel like it can be easier to work with them and work against them when you understand where their ultimate roots might be coming from.
Yeah, and not only that, and I mean, even when people talk about motherhood, I mean, you wouldn't even have motherhood to begin with if it wasn't for evolution. And even the sort of emotions that go along with it, they are also the product of evolution. So I really don't understand why talking about this from its very source, let's say, would render it undignified or something like that.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, we could talk about this in so many domains. I think of a related domain that came up the other day when I was reviewing a manuscript about, you know, perceptions of attractiveness. And, you know, I was trying to provide some feedback to authors about, it's not that physical attractiveness is, It's not that men have evolved to to emphasize attractiveness per se. It's that they have evolved to attend to attributes that signal health and fertility and a key reproductive value, and they perceive those characteristics as attractive. It's not like they value attractiveness. They value those characteristics, and those characteristics are perceived as attractive. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so those are subtle distinctions, but I guess I bring that up because I think it's so easy for people to misinterpret or judge negatively in evolutionary perspective on human behavior, because there's more nuance there than meets the eye. And you're bringing up, you know, conscious versus unconscious strategies and ultimate explanations versus proximate explanations, right? Proximate explanation is, yeah, men enjoy sex, right? Well, or they enjoy casual sex more than women do. And ultimate explanation, you know, that genes that influenced men to engage and go after casual sex would have been the genes that would have been more likely to survive and reproduce over history. Making those distinctions, I think, can be really important and protect the discipline, right, against
I mean that's a good point. And even earlier today I was talking with someone exactly about something like that. So for example, we were talking about why do men prefer women with certain physical traits that correlate with them being younger and fertile, for mm-hmm. example. And I mean, mm-hmm. what I was saying is that I mean even if you look at things from an evolutionary perspective, that would have sort of been inevitable, because we're talking about, so for example, let's imagine that at the beginning there were men that would prefer older women and others would have preferred younger women. Since the older women would already be would no longer be fertile, many of them probably, and as you get older you also increase the risk of children being born with all different yeah. sorts of conditions which would render their survival and reproduction it would be at more risk or more peril.
Yeah.
Just by the fact that certain men would be reproducing with the more fertile and younger women that would produce healthier children, and the others would be reproducing with the other women, and some of them wouldn't be reproducing at all, just over time, those preferences would have increased in frequency. And I mean, it's not that there's someone here trying to manipulate men to have these or that sort of preference, or men are doing these because they are banding together and creating this sort of patriarchy to oppress yeah. women. It's just that it's more yeah. or less inevitable, just due to certain biological facts having to do with basic reproduction and so on, that those sorts of preferences would have evolved and increased in frequency.
Yeah, yeah. I love your description of the process of selection. It operates for, you know, everything. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Like if we're thinking about the bodily attributes, right? The neck down attributes that would have facilitated reproductive success for women relative to men. We know that those attributes are very different, and it is very likely, I would be really surprised if evolution did not also end up crafting, right, psychological architecture to go right along with it. And that, of course, doesn't negate that there are differences within each sex in how strong our attitudes and feelings operate, but it doesn't mean that culture doesn't play a role, mm-hmm. but their average psychological differences should coincide with the physical differences.
By the way, since you mentioned culture, and earlier I asked you about the fact that over time, how men and women share these childcare and household tasks has changed a bit. How malleable do you think these sort of things are? I mean, so for example, if we were to try to create more, I mean, I guess we already have some data on that, on more gender equal societies, because for example, when it comes to occupational preferences, when it comes to academic preferences, when it comes to certain personality traits, there's that gender equality paradox where in societies like, for example, the Nordic European countries, it seems that some of these differences are bigger there than in less gender equal countries. So we've already answered that question partly. But to what extent do you think that these things are malleable? And to what extent do you think that via socialization we can change men's and women's preferences and things like that?
Well, we know socialization is important to the extent that, you know, socialization operates largely to try to channel, you know, men, boys, you know, larger aggressive tendencies in positive directions than negative directions. And and we see, I think, the fruits of those socialization efforts. So it's not that, you know, I think socialization is certainly a relevant force, but you know, I think probably for me, the question more is why is there a concern that we should try to mess with people's preferences if they go against their inherent proclivities? If they are not, are they hurting people? Like, is it, you know, I guess I just don't wrap my mind around the push from some people that, you know, I see quotes, although I was just reading, you know, Stephen Rhodes taking sex differences seriously and Ashley McGuire's the sex scandal. And there are so many feminist writers who they seem to have this like fear of inherent differences between the sexes. And that if, you know, it's almost like, it reminds me of Darwin's, was it his wife or sister saying, you know, if evolution is true, let's not talk about it. I can't remember the exact quote, but it's almost like some of these feminist authors, certain types of feminist authors, are concerned that if these biologically influenced, not determined, but biologically influenced sex differences are real, then they will just perpetuate a status quo where women engage in more childcare and hold more responsibility for various household tasks, not all, than men do. And I think, but if they're not dissatisfied in their relationships and they enjoy engaging in those activities, why is that a problem? I got, you know, and I've had people say, well, women, they've just been brainwashed by society. They don't realize it's a problem. And then I think, why are you telling me that I actually don't really know what I enjoy? Like, how demeaning is that? That to me, that's demeaning, that I wouldn't actually know my, you know, whether I like changing a diaper or not, or whether I find it fulfilling to play with my child or not. So, you know, I'm sure that socialization is relevant, you know, providing boys and girls exposure to changing diapers means that both children might be better prepared to babysit in middle, you know, when they're adolescents, right? If you, if you teach them how to do dishes and you know, show them how to do laundry and you show them how to cook mac and cheese and change diapers and on all that stuff, then both of them are going to, you know, like thinking about just your own children, right? They're both going to be ready to babysit in adolescence. But is it likely that there is going to be a sex difference in their desire to find a babysitting job? Probably, you know, and that initial interest in learning about babies and doing this activity around the house as opposed to outside the house, learning how to mow the lawn. Is it likely that boys, can girls be socialized to you know, enjoy mowing the lawn? Probably. Are they going to, on average, enjoy it less than boys? Probably. So I guess for me, it's like, why are people so wrapped up in there being parity across the board for everything?
Mm-hmm.
If from my perspective, if males and females are on average different in both their physical and psychological hardware, we shouldn't be demanding socialization that goes against nature in such a way, especially if it's not harmful.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that feminists and, I mean, perhaps on the other side of the spectrum, you would get male rights activists or something like that. I mean, these people tend to oversimplify things, and they think about things like everything is just one factor or something like that. So, for example, mm-hmm. if you find difference in distribution between men and women across different occupations or across different fields in university, then that's immediately an indicator of sexism or something like that. But I mean, for me, I don't understand exactly why, for example, it's a problem to have 90% male engineers and, on the other hand, 80 or 90% females in psychology or the social sciences. I mean, why is that a problem if people are simply following their preferences? I mean, that for me, I would even interpret that as a positive thing, because in countries where people have less opportunities, that doesn't happen. And those are precisely the countries where you would find more equal sex distributions across the different areas. But people on those countries, at least they appear to be more miserable than people who can make their own choices, whatever that leads to more skewed sex distributions across different occupations and so on, then a 50-50 split in certain areas. I mean, for example, I personally am much more interested in whatever choices people make, that they are able to earn a living wage with whatever kind of occupation they have, than having 50-50 male-female across all different occupations, and particularly more so because the feminists, they seem to be only interested in the higher status occupations, because, for example, there are lots and lots of males working in low-wage jobs, but I don't see many feminists worrying about the 50-50 split when it comes to those kinds of occupations. So, I mean, it seems a little bit silly to me.
Yeah, and I think there are some occupations, right, where we know that, especially when women were first entering those domains,
mm-hmm.
not having very many other women around and having a very, you know, male environment can make things very difficult. But we see the push for parity. Going back to that can, you can see how having a certain threshold number of women could be really important for making sure it's welcoming to women who want that, right? So
right. Yeah.
Making sure that the environment is friendly toward those who want that as an occupation or pursuit. I think about debates in the military, you know, where we in order to have a proportionality of the sexes in different positions, in some cases they may be modifying the standards. So women have a different standard, right, to live up to than men, and in order to pass, or in order to make sure that you can get as many women as men to meet the standard, you just lower the standard. But in this way, you're actually lowering the standard for everybody, right? That can, you know, what are the outcomes of that? So I think, I mean, I resonate toward the idea of trade-offs here. Every decision that we make has a trade-off. And, mm-hmm. you know, we don't live in utopia at the individual level or at the societal level, right? So we have to make trade-offs. And I think hopefully the data that science produces can help us understand what those trade-offs are so that our values can help guide those decisions.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that, for example, women's emancipation back in the 60s, 70s was very good. But if you look at things, for example, now you have many more women in certain areas, like I mentioned, the psychology and the social sciences, but also in medicine, for example. But that's mm-hmm. also not exactly random. It has to do with, for example, the reason why you find 90% of engineers being male and a good percentage of doctors now being female has to do with the interest in people versus the interest in things difference discovered by people like Baron Cohen and others. So, I mean, it's interesting because when certain people have this idea that if we take some obstacles out of the way, then it will lead to a perfect 50-50 split, but that's not exactly what happens. I mean, people simply follow their preferences, and in certain areas, yeah, perhaps it's close to that 50-50 split, but in other areas, due to that big sex difference, I mean, that doesn't happen. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's just people following their preferences.
It reminds me of the argument made in the, you know, not too long ago, right, that we shouldn't offer stay at home as an option to mothers precisely because they'll take it. Now I think, wow, that's so interesting. And I wonder if when I was 20 and didn't have kids yet, would I have felt a little bit of a lean toward, yeah, that's right. You know, women need to pursue their careers to the max. But then I think about data suggesting that even today, you know, nearly 50% of women prefer that, you know, yeah, I would want to stay home if I could for at least a while, you know, when their kids are young. Why is that bad for children's development to have, you know, an investing parent? And certainly it sort of resonates with what we would have seen over evolutionary history and what we see in traditional societies. And then I think about data, suggesting that modern women, young women, really, the majority think they can have kids easily into their 40s. And that just goes against what we know about fertility and conception rates. Mm-hmm. So I think, I had another thought too, as you were talking about viewing things as, say, one factor only. And I do think that there are variables like interest in people versus things or organic versus inorganic that go a long ways toward explaining at least, you know, a good some 10 to 15% of the variance in occupational preferences, if not more. But even then, that doesn't mean that there aren't other variables that are relevant. And I agree with you that I think some people get caught up in thinking that there's just one factor, you know, that magic bullet. And we've seen people lose their jobs, right, over suggesting that it's not all about discrimination. It's not all about sexism, that there may be other competing factors at play. Distributional differences in cognitive ability patterns, you know, spatial, quantitative versus verbal abilities, and preferences in people versus things, conation, drive for, you know, long hours at work, status driving, all of these factors are relevant. So when you take all those factors and you think about the evolutionary underpinnings of them, I think I'm with you that I don't see parity as the in every domain as the end goal. It seems unrealistic and it and perhaps iatrogenic, right? Like maybe going against what people may find most fulfilling.
Yeah. So just one last question. I mean, do you think that it's hard for women nowadays to make this sort of trade-off between investing in their family versus investing in their careers? And I mean, do you think that that might bring some sort of negative psychological consequences? I mean, having to do that, having to work around that kind of trade-off.
Yeah. I'm reminded of Barry Schwartz. I don't know if you've ever seen a TED talk he gives, but he also wrote a book called The Paradox of Choice. And he talks about how, in his TED talk, he talks about how he was, this is from like 10 or 15 years ago, but at that time, he's like, I'm giving my students less work. And it's not because they're any less smart. It's that they're plagued by these decisions about what to do with their lives because they have so much freedom to choose. They have so many choices to make. And they, you know, at the same time that there are limits, they also are told that they can do anything, you know, that they can choose whatever major they want. They can choose any career they want. And they can get married or not, and they can cohabit or not, or they can be this gender identity or not, or they can be this, you know, they have so much choice. There's so much choice. And I think to some degree it can be overwhelming. Certainly individual differences in personality traits can make this more or less overwhelming. But I think it does have consequences. And I think the idea that you can have it all, that you can have everything you want is dangerous. I think about a data set I collected last year, the year before, looking at young men's and women's commitment to work, commitment to family, commitment to kind of like, there were like three different roles. I'm trying to remember what the third one was. Women were at the max for all of them. You know, they just foresaw a future of being 100% committed to everything. And they foresaw a life of more commitment to work than the young men in the sample did. And maybe the young men in our sample were a little bit lost. I mean, there is concern about young males feeling a little more lost these days. I don't know for sure about that. But to me, what was striking is the women who were, like, in my mind, not recognizing that there is limited time. There's limited time.
Yeah, and in that way,
within a day and within a lifespan.
Yeah, and in that way, perhaps, again, from a biological perspective, they can't be exactly equal to men, because, I mean, women have a concrete biological limit to their reproduction, and that's not really the same for males. Yeah. So, I mean, they also have to take that into account. And, I mean, I would imagine that, for example, if a woman wants to invest their time in taking care of children and raising children versus a career, for example, or vice versa, I mean, that's perfectly fine, but perhaps trying to combine those two things or even more than that, I mean, it gets really, really complicated. And that's also perhaps one of the reasons why there's one of the factors that explains, for example, the gender pay gap, is that at a certain point there are many more women than men working part-time and deciding to invest more in their family than their careers, because, I mean, that's simply a biological impulse they have.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when the time comes for them to make a choice, that's what they tend to prefer in comparison to men.
Yeah. I mean, I think some people would say, well, when households end up in that position, you know, the men may be more likely to have a higher paying job because of the types of paths that they pursued. And then women are just oppressed into this childcare household role. But at the same time, we see samples like mine and others who've collected data on young people, including college students and longitudinal data on college students who, you know, both in their first year in college and in their fourth year in college, their plans for the future, women's are far more likely to include a preference to stay at home, just as you say, like they, you know, there is some choice there. And I'm not suggesting that there aren't women who are dissatisfied with their arrangement being at home, because I think sometimes that happens.
Of course.
But there also are men. There also are men who stay at home and are not necessarily satisfied with that arrangement. Right. We're just talking average trends here.
Yeah, and I mean, before we finish, perhaps it's important to leave this clear. I mean, we're not at all saying here that women should prefer investing in their family versus their career and men the opposite or anything in between. I mean, it's just that people can make their choices, whatever they might be, but when we look at the data, there are certain trends that men and women tend to follow, and they end up in certain positions and they decide to make these trade-offs and invest more in one thing than the other. And I mean, we're simply describing here how things are. We're not saying that men or women should make this or that choice or should behave this or that way. I mean, whatever they want to do, if it works for them, at least in my perspective, it's perfectly okay.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And I like how you say that. I mean, the is does not equate to ought. And in fact, I would argue that sometimes when we start with an ought, we can be shooting ourselves in the foot, right? Like think about that example of men ought to be taking parental leave at the same rate as women are. So we design a program where, you know, women can't have leave unless it's paternal, you know, like you can't have leave unless there's paternal leave also. But then you have reports of the men being more likely to use the leave in such a way that facilitates their career path, right, than really facilitates childcare support. Is that helpful to women's success in academia, right? Those are, you know, tenure track policies or whatever. So starting with an ought to create an is, maybe in some situations could be as dangerous as assuming that what is ought to be, right? So maybe, and I'm not certain, right? I'm just thinking about this off the cuff, but I am thinking, you know, we always say just because something is that way and we have an evolutionary understanding of why it might be, that doesn't mean that that's the way it ought to be. But just because, you know, you have an idea of how things ought to be, well, number one, that doesn't mean that that is what people are going to think down the road of how things ought to be, because we know our understanding of morals and values changes with time and historical, you know, context. But also going for ought to create the is can be dangerous as well.
Yeah, and I guess perhaps not only that, but also if you start with the oughts, then maybe you as a feminist have a certain kind of ideology and you think that women should be more career oriented, for example, and not as much family oriented. But then why don't you try ask women themselves, I mean, common women that are not necessarily, do not necessarily have that ideology, and see if what they really prefer. I mean, perhaps you would get a surprise.
Yeah, it's always a fun conversation in a classroom with young women. You know, we'll talk about the sex, you know, the average sex differences in, say, desire to have time at home, to work part-time, for example. And certainly, you know, the women in the room will vary tremendously in their plans at that point in their life. But in the midst of discussion, I've had women say, you know, I'm not going to college to be a stay-at-home mom. And then I've had other women come back at them and say, you know, I'm going to college to be educated and you know, a learner no matter what I do. And wouldn't I be a better stay-at-home mom with a college education than without? You know, and I think that's a really nice, you know, you see both sides there, right? Yeah. And you also see that within any group, a group of women, a group of men, huge differences in where their preferences are at any given time point, because I wish I could follow those women up 10 years later and be like, so now how do you feel? And of course I don't have them, but I wish I did.
Yeah. Okay, so I will be leaving then a link to your paper in the description box of the interview. Where can people find you on the internet or your work?
Well, I'm not on Twitter. I've taken people's warnings quite seriously, including my husband's, like, stay off Twitter. You don't want to do that. I'm not on Twitter. But I'm at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, and I do have a website, bleskyrecheck.com. So I think I'm pretty easy to find, and I try to keep that site updated regularly. And I so appreciate you having me, Ricardo. It was fun to talk.
No, it was really fun. It was really a really fun conversation. And thank you so much for taking the time.
All right. Take care.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. I would just like to ask you, if you can, to please consider supporting the show for it to keep running. You will find links to my Patreon page and also to PayPal in the description box of this interview. Any amount, even just $1 per month, will already be a great help. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share the interview, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at enlights.com. And finally, I would like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Kenneth Litzke and Blanchett, Per Orgel Larsen, Logurero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunde, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollacy, Henry Kalanias, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Nassio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Mark Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, George Spinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Denbauer, Omri Hickson, Fergal Kersen, Evan Bodrenko, Hal Herzog, John Ross, Jonathan Librand, Oslem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Weira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yasila Dez Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevsky, Nelek Bach, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Elman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmidis, Saima Afzal, Adrian Yegi, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Jules Price, Edward Hall, my producers, Cesar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Tafiniak, Ian Gilligan, Sergio Quadriano, Luis Caetano, Tom Venegdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Gidi, Sardas France, and Nirban Balachandran, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, James Pratt, and Matthew Lavender. Thank you for all.